You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the City of Man podcast. This is Ed Song coming to you live. Well, not live, probably, from when you listen to this. But anyway, it's from Santa Barbara, California, where I am an associate professor of philosophy. With me is my partner in crime, Mr. Coyle Neal, associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University. Mr. Neal, guten Morgen to you.
Hey Ed, I'm also live and will still be live when people listen to this, I hope.
Well, let's not make promises we can't keep, Coyle.
Right, right.
How has your summer been?
It's been pretty good. Kind of expensive for us. We've had several things die on us, various appliances. So I've been kept hopping trying to fix stuff myself with my limited technical ability. And then,
so like washer and dryer, dishwasher, that kind of a thing?
Dishwasher, air conditioner.
Oh.
I feel like there was something else in there, and I'm blanking on it now. So,
well, air conditioning probably isn't a necessity for you in the end of July in the summer, right?
In the swamp, yeah. It's, you know,
I hope
it could
sarcasm
be worse.
Translates.
Yeah, it does. It certainly could be worse. So at the beginning of Ben Sasse's book, The Vanishing American Adult, he talks about how his kids were complaining because it was like 70 degrees in the house. And that's when he realized that there was this problem with, you know, Americans being a bunch of adolescents. So we weren't quite that bad, but it was definitely,
so,
I was definitely
sorry,
thinking
70 is too warm. Is that the story that's going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, they were like, we needed the air conditioner on. And
what do you set your air conditioner at?
In the summer?
I'm sure this is fascinating conversation.
It really, what do we set our air conditioner on? Sorry, the wife just came in. Our air conditioner's on like 74 in the summer. Just because it's expensive. Sorry, that was the kids in the background. It's, you know, expensive to run, so we're cheap, but we also like the cold, and that's the trap we get caught in.
I'm kind of cold, cold-blooded. I get cold at, like, if we're in a hotel room, I'll set it at 72. But at home, man, I mean, we live in a much cooler temperate place than you all. I mean, it can get hot where we live, but like, I don't know, like 76 or 74.
Yeah, I mean, I like it cold, but again, I also don't like giving power companies money. Yeah. So that's the catch 22 in the summer.
Yeah.
It's easier in the winter. We just don't turn the furnace on all that often, and the house stays kind of chilly, and guests can deal with it. So,
are you wearing like a wool hat? Like some kind of medieval scribe or something like that?
No, I like the cold. So,
all right.
How do we get on that? All right, but all of that will probably have to be edited out.
No,
because,
come on.
Gosh, it can't be interesting to anyone.
That's incredibly stimulating, interesting conversation.
How was your summer, Ed?
It's been amazing. We might talk about this later. I just got back from the Free Methodist General Conference. It was an amazing, amazing experience for me. I was telling Coyle when we just got on. In some ways, it was probably one of the most significant experiences that I've had as a Christian since I became a believer. But then more important, we went on the new Harry Potter ride, which was equally a kind of a religious experience.
Also the most important religious experience.
Right? It was up there, the Hagrid ride. It was pretty great. Recommend it. The crazy thing is, we got there right, like, 15 minutes before it opened, and then when they opened the gate, we ran to the Hagrid ride. And then it was a super long line but it was always moving. And we probably only waited 15 or 20 minutes. But if you had gotten there 10 minutes later or 15 minutes later, you would have waited for 4 hours. So my travel advice to our listeners, if you're heading to Orlando Universal Studios this summer, is to get there early and run. Run for your lives, but it's worth it.
And my travel advice to our listeners is don't go to Orlando in late July, because that's insane.
Well, you know, we used to live in Louisiana. I do like a good heat, actually, getting back to getting back to our earlier conversation about air conditioning. But speaking of heat, how's that for
nice, a topic?
You know, Coyle and I, we haven't really been doing many, like, political episodes. That is to say, episodes talking about things going on in contemporary politics, much in a while, I think. And that's probably a strength for us, since we're both trained as theorists. Well, I mean, you're a political scientist, so you think about institutions and things going on more than
us. I mean, I'm also trained as a political theorist, so I do, because I think about institutions because I have to for my job, but my training is all Aristotle and Augustine and those guys, so I'm in kind of the same boat.
Yeah. But we thought that we would turn back to the dirty business of politics and talk about impeachment. That is obviously not just an accidental topic for us. I mean, the topic of impeachment, I mean, I think the question and issue of impeachment is a really interesting theoretical and practical issue. It's obviously addressed in our Constitution, and just thinking about procedures in which we remove elected officials is kind of an interesting kind of a thing, but it's obviously not just a theoretical topic for us, as it is a little bit in the news these days. So we thought that we'd kick things off talking a little bit about the history of impeachment in the United States, the language in the Constitution, and how it works. So, Coyle, why don't you kick us off and talk to us a little bit about what the Constitution has to say about impeachment in the United States.
So obviously it is important. It's mentioned six times in the Constitution. So it's up there in terms of things that the framers thought were worth mentioning. And it is important historically. So far, 19 federal officials have been brought up for impeachment in U.S. history, 8 of whom were actually removed. And if that sounds weird, the process is the actual impeachment takes place in the House of Representatives. So the House alone can impeach someone. The Senate will then decide whether or not to remove someone from office. And that's the only punishment. There's nothing beyond that other than removal from office and then disqualification from holding further office. So constitutionally, this offense can't be pardoned by the president. There's no right in these cases to a trial by jury, and precedent isn't binding in any meaningful sense. So just because something has been done one way in the past doesn't mean it has to be done that way again. And because this is such a rare event, the rules for this are somewhat lax, which is interesting in Congress because they're so rule bound in so many ways. But because impeachment is so rare, the process is always sort of ad hoc. And maybe just briefly before talking about how it's happened in the past. The process, again, pretty straightforward. So in the House, a committee will be formed to launch an investigation and report back to the whole chamber. If they recommend impeachment, then there will be a House vote with a simple majority sufficient for impeachment. So I don't know if you watched it. You might have been in Orlando when this was going on. But the House vote on whether or not to impeach Donald Trump last week or the week before.
I was in Orlando. I was up to my eyeballs in either resolutions and bills or like butterbeer and
right. Well, whichever whenever it was, all they needed was that simple majority, and of course they didn't get it. So that's on the House side. If you get the simple majority, you're now an impeached government official. One out of, I guess if we had another one, you'd be one out of 20. And then the trial goes over to the Senate side. If it's the president being impeached, then the Chief Justice presides over the Senate trial. If it is not the president being impeached, it's just whoever happens to be chairing the Senate, whoever's presiding over the Senate that day. One of the interesting things that Rehnquist liked to talk about is that the last time it had happened when he presided over Clinton's impeachment was, under Andrew Johnson. So there were basically no rules. Right. Should this look like a courtroom case? Should this look like a regular meeting of the Senate? Should it look more like a Supreme Court conference? Like, what are the rules here? Does the defendant get a chance to have his say, or do you just hold the up down vote? I mean, how does any of this even work? And he had to kind of work with Senate leadership to hammer all of that out.
You know, it's a kind of an interesting thing, the way in which those procedures are open ended. I mean, do you take that to be an oversight of constitutional specificity, or is it a bug or a feature, or do they purposely leave it open-ended precisely to provide for flexibility in circumstances that almost, you know, that you could hardly imagine.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution doesn't, it basically doesn't say anything about procedure. So the procedure for passing a bill, all it says is has to pass the House and pass the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. And then the numbers of votes you need for overriding a presidential veto, it gives you those. It doesn't say anything about how it goes through the House or how it goes through the Senate. So that's not unusual in that sense. Where impeachment is different is that it's happened so rarely that the regularizing of the procedure hasn't happened in the same way it has in other places. So
clearly we need to be impeaching a lot more people just so, you know, get good at
it. There may be something to that. The problem is, and we'll get into this, the problem is defining when someone should be impeached. Right. So
there's the rub, obviously.
Yeah, it really is. So just briefly, who have we impeached in the past? 19 federal officials, 8 of whom were removed. These are mostly judges.
Yeah.
Mostly charged with drunkenness is actually a pretty common one. Abuse of power or obstruction of justice. So 3 of the 19 took place in the first 15 years of the Republic. Basically, the same people managed all 3 of these impeachments. The first one ever was a senator who had received money from the British government in order to raise a private army to invade and conquer Florida away from the Spanish.
And they said that was wrong?
It's really interesting. It was not a crime, right? It wasn't against the law to do that.
Yeah.
And yet they thought that was conduct unbecoming a senator. So the House impeached him before they could finish the process. The Senate removed him from office because they didn't want the House to be part of the process of removing a senator.
Well, and what are the conditions under which the Senate can remove a senator?
They're in-house rules, so they can remove a senator for any reason they want to, whatever their in-house rules are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean they get to define what makes someone a senator in good standing. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the House. The House gets to set those rules also.
Mm-hmm.
So the other two from the early Republic, a federal district judge who was both an alcoholic and who had apparently gone insane while in office, got impeached. Again, neither of those things are necessarily crimes, but they clearly keep him from being able to do the job. And then the other official who was impeached was a Supreme Court justice who had committed the crime of being a Federalist while Jefferson's Democrats controlled the legislative and executive branches. The Senate did not remove him from office, but he scaled back his political speeches that he'd been giving in the circuit, on the public circuit.
Uh-huh. But that was more of a political impeachment.
That was kind of a naked political attempt to smack down what was left of the Federalist Party. And I don't want to get too much into this, but it's interesting to note, if you look at the early part of the 19th century, the Federalist Party basically dies after John Adams leaves office, except in the courts because of life appointments. So Adams packs the courts on his way out. So for the next 30 years, the only place there are any Federalists anywhere in the country is in the court system. So the Democrats basically putting them back in line, which they mostly fall in line after that.
Well, how many Jeffersonian Democrats have rap Broadway musicals written about them?
not many. Just Aaron Burr, right?
Yeah, but he's a minor figure, a bad guy.
More recently, we've had 2 impeachments in the last decade. So the judge of the Eastern Louisiana District, federal judge in the Eastern Louisiana District, was impeached and removed in 2010 for making false financial disclosures. And then in 2009, the judge of the Texas Southern District was impeached and removed for sexual assault and obstruction of justice. So, again, it is something that happens more than just, we think, Bill Clinton, Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, but it's not super common.
So in both of those cases, the House got together and voted, and the Senate tried the person in question.
Yes. And they were both removed from office.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess when we think about impeachment, we think about presidential impeachments.
Right.
Because of how big and dramatic they are. But it's just kind of interesting that, like, these things happen. I mean, maybe not in the normal course of the life of the legislature, but anyways.
Yeah, I mean, statistically, if you serve a regular term in Congress, you're probably going to vote on at least one impeachment. It makes sense that there would be more judges involved because of the life term, right? If the president does something awful, 4 to 8 years, like that's going to be the end of the term. Whereas the judge, if he does something awful, he's there until mm-hmm. he retires or dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also like the judge isn't a federal judge isn't an elected official,
Right.
And so there's a way in which you're not overturning some democratic procedure.
Yeah, and we should talk about that when we get to reasons for impeachment. I the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced it's not actually overturning a democratic procedure, even to impeach the president. Let's hold off on that.
Okay.
Just to wrap up the history, presidential impeachments, those are the ones that make news, right? So Bill Clinton is our most recently impeached president. He was impeached for perjuring himself before a federal grand jury concerning his relationship with a subordinate government employee and with regard to what he had said in a lawsuit filed by Paula Jones. And he was impeached for obstruction of justice, both in the Jones lawsuit and in the course of the federal grand jury's investigation. He also encouraged Monica Lewinsky to lie and offered to get her a job in order to influence her testimony. The articles of impeachment said that this undermined the integrity of his office and perverted the rule of law and justice.
Sorry, what was the specific thing about the perjury in the Paula Jones case?
Yeah, I don't know the actual details. She had filed a civil suit against him, and he lied somewhere along the way in the course of that. I don't know what the specific
lie
was.
Is that separate from what he said about the relationship with Lewinsky? Or is
yes.
That just...
Yeah, so there were two incidents of perjury that would get lumped into the same article, of impeachment.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think about that impeachment hearing at the time?
I mean, at the time, I was 15 and, probably an idiot. So my thoughts at the time are, I don't remember, and B, they were probably not terribly well informed. Looking back now, I'm probably going to say some version of this later. A different Congress would have been... I would have been more in favor of the impeachment of Clinton had there been different people at the helm in Congress. Functionally, I think it was just a naked power play by Newt Gingrich against Bill Clinton, which isn't to say Clinton didn't deserve to be impeached. Mm-hmm. But coming from the person it came from, I think that makes it more of a challenge. If you'd had someone who was kind of less aggressively partisan in the role of speaker, it would have been a very different story. And mm-hmm. and I think that actually that's relevant now too. But we'll get to that. Anything else on Clinton? Obviously he'll keep coming back up. But
nope.
So before that, Nixon resigns before he could be impeached, and then gets pardoned by Gerald Ford. The articles of impeachment included obstruction of justice. That obstruction included bribery, deception of the American people, and I love this quote, acting in a manner contrary to his trust as president and subversive of constitutional government. And then he also was impeached for abuse of executive power, and interestingly, violation of separation of powers. When the House subpoenaed the White House tapes, he refused to turn them over, so they said, hey, you're trying to take executive branch control over the impeachment process, which that was actually included in the first set of articles against Clinton, and the House wasn't sold on that, so that, mm-hmm. that got dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, Lyndon Johnson is impeached formally in 1868 for violation
Not
of
Lyndon,
the,
Andrew.
Sorry, Andrew Johnson. Yeah, Andrew Johnson. Impeached for a violation of the Tenure of Office Act, which said that the president could not fire an official who'd been confirmed by the Senate without the Senate's permission. This act was later both repealed by Congress and overturned by the Supreme Court, but neither of those things had happened yet. He was also impeached for, quote, inflammatory and scandalous speeches. In one, he blamed riots in New Orleans on the Congress, saying that they had planned it and that every drop of blood that was shed fell on them. And then in another speech, he said that he wanted to have the Speaker of the House hanged.
That sounds like something a certain contemporary American president
It does, in fact, sound like that. although presidential standards of speech were very different back then. So, for example, it was understood that you would not talk about policy in public, like the speeches in favor of whatever your issues were just not the gentlemanly thing to do. And then prior to Johnson, James Buchanan.
Wait, so but just to be clear, so when you say impeached, do you mean that, charges of impeachment were drawn up?
So the House voted to impeach him. The Senate did not remove him from office.
Yes, acquitted him. Maybe that's not the right language.
Yeah, there's not really a word for it. So when we say the Senate convicts them, even that's not quite the right word.
Yeah. Well, they didn't remove him from office by a single vote, I think.
Yeah, one vote for him, and I think it was five votes for Clinton. So it was it was within five
you
votes
need,
for him.
Yeah, and you need 2/3.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was more than five votes for Clinton. I don't remember off the top of my head now. And then prior to Johnson, James Buchanan was investigated by a House committee who cleared him of charges but found that his administration was the most corrupt so far in U.S. history. So that's those three, really, Nixon, Johnson, and Clinton. Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton are the big three, and then Buchanan's sort of a footnote to that. Anything out of any of that before we get into the
nope.
weeds of impeachment?
Nope.
Yeah. So the difficulty, as you said earlier, the challenge is why should you impeach someone? So the Constitution says treason, bribery, those are pretty straightforward, right? If the president is receiving money or services or goods from another country in exchange for something, well, that's treason, right? Same thing with bribery. If he's someone's writing him a check to veto a law, those are both pretty straightforward. But where it gets tricky is with high crimes and misdemeanors. So. What do those mean? And there's not really an easy answer to that. A misdemeanor probably doesn't mean jaywalking. At the time would have had a broader construction, so would have meant evil conduct, bad behavior, mismanagement. In the same way, high crimes doesn't necessarily mean exceptionally awful crimes. It doesn't just mean how serious the offense is, although it also means that. It means that it's committed by someone who's in a high office. So Madison clarifies this, which is of course not authoritative because he doesn't clarify it in the Constitution. He says that someone should be impeached for incapacity, negligence, and perfidy. And I don't know if I'm saying perfidy right because I don't know that I've ever heard it said, but those are Madison's three things. Hamilton says that offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men are the reasons we should impeach someone. Yeah, so those are the reasons. Things that are not on the list that people usually fall back on. Political disagreement. I radically disagreed with Barack Obama's healthcare policy. That doesn't mean he should be impeached for it. Mild incompetence, maybe even not so mild incompetence, isn't necessarily on the list. Certain kinds of bad personal or public behavior, being unpopular or losing the people's confidence, even breaking the law isn't explicitly on the list. And in part, that's presumably because there just weren't many federal crimes in the early days of the Republic, but also because criminal law is different than impeachment is. The point of criminal law is deterrence or punishment. Impeachment specifically carries no additional punishment with it. The point of impeachment is not to deter and it's not to punish. It's something else. I'm sorry if I'm rambling here. With all of that said, to some extent, obviously, things like incompetence and mismanagement have to be on the list in principle, even if they're not explicitly mentioned. And the classic example, this comes from a book called Impeachment: A Handbook. Says that suppose a president were to move to Saudi Arabia so that he could have four wives, and were to propose to conduct the office of the presidency by mail and wireless from there. This would not be a crime, provided his passport were in order. Is it possible that such gross and wanton neglect of duty could not be grounds for impeachment and removal? And that's sort of the law school question that you throw out and then let people kick around. The House has clarified its own processes. After Nixon resigns, the House committee releases a report called Constitutional Grounds for Presidential Impeachment, which is attempting to explain when they will impeach someone. They give three circumstances. First, abuse of power. Second, using one's office for personal gain. And third, and those first two are pretty straightforward, I think, but the third one is where, once again, things get a little vague. Behaving in a manner grossly incompatible with the proper function and purpose of the office. When the official's conduct seriously undermines public confidence in his ability to perform his official functions. And the key word in all of this in the report is substantiality. Impeachment must be for something that seriously compromises either the form and the principles of the republic or the ability of the official to properly do their job. So perjury might theoretically always be a high crime or misdemeanor. It might not always be impeachable. So in the same way, tweeting or going on vacation and golfing every weekend may never technically be a high crime or misdemeanor. It's not against the law, but they might sometimes be impeachable. Mm-hmm. So this House report sort of clarifies things, but then doesn't actually clarify anything.
With So a question about the status of that House report.
Yeah.
What that's just a House committee report.
Right. It is not binding on anyone.
And anyone. So can we think about that a little bit? So the official constitutional language is impeachment for a conviction of treason.
Right.
I think. Well, I mean, even that. So what counts as treason?
Well, again, that's one of those things that I think is fairly straightforward. If you are selling secrets to a foreign nation or just giving secrets,
well, what if you're receiving help from a foreign nation for your election?
Well, that is legitimately fair. Or what if you are bragging about all the stuff you know in the Oval Office in front of the Russian ambassador, and you let slip classified information?
I
don't know that is technically treason.
The latter to me is different because it doesn't imply bad intention.
Right. Right. And I don't know that receiving assistance from the Russians, I mean, you would have to show that he knew he was doing it and that he meant to do it rather than just benefiting from it. And I think that's going to be a hard sell because I don't think Trump knows anything. So,
yeah, or what he knows on Tuesday, he might not know on Wednesday.
Right.
But treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right. So high crimes and misdemeanors is the big question mark.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's such an interesting phrase, crimes and misdemeanors. And as you know, so I'm just looking at the text of the Constitution right now. High is not capitalized and crimes and misdemeanors is capitalized.
Sure.
So as you know, the point behind high is that it notes political location, not like severity of the act.
Right.
Right? And it modifies both crimes and misdemeanors. So it's high crimes and high misdemeanors, as it were.
Right. So if the president, strangles someone in the White House basement, right, that is a high crime or misdemeanor. Jaywalking, speeding, right, those may not be.
Yeah, well, okay, but those are pretty clearly misdemeanors, no?
They are, but are they high misdemeanors?
Ah, okay. And again, the point about high is that it refers to the administrative or political location of the person in question.
Right.
So it would be impossible for me to commit a high crime or misdemeanor because I'm not in a political office.
Right. Your highest rank right now is citizen.
Yes.
So
we could have a debate about whether you could perform high crimes and misdemeanors.
I could perform high crimes. So I certainly could.
I mean, you're not
could.
A federal official, so none of this applies. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, whatever our local impeachment processes are. But yeah, I mean, certainly it is possible.
Yeah, okay. And so now we talk about the president. And now the question that we ask ourselves is, so the president is obviously a high official.
Sure.
Is the idea here that the misdemeanor in question has to be connected to the office, as it were? Right?
Well, again, that's not spelled out.
Yeah. But so on your reading, jaywalking isn't a misdemeanor because it's not a political misdemeanor. It's not a high misdemeanor in that way because it's not connected to the official's high office. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, and I think I could even go a step farther and say that because of, say, the culture of DC. Further?
I think, but it's strictly because I always get those mixed up.
Let's go a bit more. Let's consider this matter more deeply. In the culture of DC, jaywalking is fairly common and occasionally necessary if you want to actually get across the street. So yes, it is always technically a misdemeanor in the strict legal sense of the term, but it is not a misdemeanor such that would compromise any aspect of the presidency, either in his personal behavior or in his public behavior.
Yeah, okay, so here's another question, and we're just focusing on the idea of crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
The president is doing drugs. That's a crime, I guess. That's not even just a misdemeanor. But let's say the president is doing drugs, but that's not... Do you see what I'm getting at? I'm trying to make a distinction between personal crimes and misdemeanors, as it were, and high crimes and misdemeanors. But you are implying that the high there implies political acts that are attached to their office. Yeah, so strictly speaking on that read, you're okay.
Yeah, again, I don't want to say that because the text doesn't say that.
I mean, you could. That's what I thought you were getting at. I mean, that's what I thought you were implying. So high crimes and misdemeanors. High means misdemeanors that are attached to one's political office. That's what I thought you were getting at.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to. I don't want to be dogmatic about that because I think, it may be that the president could murder someone in his private capacity as an individual.
Yeah, right. If he murdered a political rival, that would clearly be impeachable. But right. If he just murdered somebody for having an affair with his wife.
Right. Or if there's a Profiles episode coming out about that. That didn't used to be a crime. If he personally murders someone because he doesn't like them, right? I think we could say that's definitely impeachable. In the same way, if he orders the Secret Service to murder someone using his authority as president, that is also impeachable.
Yeah.
Then we start getting into vague territory. Well, what if he orders the CIA to execute, say, Osama bin Laden, right? Why is that not impeachable, whereas using the government to go after, corporate enemies is? Well, again, we start talking about, is he using the office for personal gain, right? Even if the same order is being given, and even if it's, a foreign national involved, right? All of these different criteria that go into it, and it gets really complicated.
Okay. So when we read Section 4 of Article 2, I guess, of the Constitution, when it says high crimes and misdemeanors, I think the takeaway there is that the Constitution is pretty deliberately vague.
Right. It means whatever the House of Representatives wants it to mean. I mean, that's at the end of the day. They are the final arbiters of its meaning.
Sure.
It's been fairly consistent, you know.
Yeah, and then we look again at this 1974 House Judiciary Committee report that tries to spell out a little bit more about the kinds of considerations that ought to drive it. And so again, they say abuse of power, okay. Using one's post for personal gain, okay. Behaving in a manner grossly incompatible with the proper function and purpose of the office. When the official conduct seriously undermines public confidence in his ability to perform his official functions. And then, as you note, the question is seriously, or the substantiality of the behavior in question. Considering, if you just think about the idea of high crimes and misdemeanors abstractly, it doesn't seem like your sort of law school class example of a president moving to Saudi Arabia and kind of abdicating his responsibilities counts.
I think the language is vague enough that it could count, right? So if the president's like, oh, no, I can still be president, and I'll still sign bills, and I'll still veto things, I'll just do it all from Saudi Arabia, I think at that point the House could say, no, you have now violated
that's kind of the thing about the constitutional language. I mean, crimes and misdemeanors, that's not just like bad behavior, right? Those are formal legal breaches. And it looks like in the example, there's no formal legal breach.
Right. And there I would want to look at that older sort of broader definition of misdemeanor and say, yeah, it also includes things like bad conduct. Right. So part of the issue is for us, misdemeanor has this very specific, very limited meaning, and that is not necessarily the case.
Your point is that it's okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay.
I'm kind of curious because I assume this is where we're going, Ed. We're 3 years into the first term of the Trump presidency. Do you think he should be impeached? Like, do you think he meets any of the criteria we've?
Parenthetical question. Sure. When you call it the first term of the Trump presidency, are you implying that you think there's going to be a second term?
I've been wrong about politics a lot for the past few years, but the standard political science models say there's a very good chance of it.
Yeah.
I just don't think Marianne Williamson can pull off the win against Donald Trump, but we'll see.
Now what was your question back to me?
Do you think he meets the criteria of impeachment?
So, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is that I think with a lot of difficult questions, we expect clear answers, when the fact of the matter is the universe doesn't always give us clear answers. And sure. So, my deeply enlightened answer to that question is, I don't know. And a little bit of the point that I think I want to make is that we rightly hallow the rule of law and the application of uniform, fair administrative procedures that assure fairness in the application of the law. Like, that's really important. But in some ways, rule of law isn't the only thing that matters. Because, even as we're talking about the complexity of trying to understand exactly what the law says about such matters, there are, like, norms, right? And norms of governance that are formed certainly by texts, but also history and practice and culture and values. And, I can't remember whether we talked about, we chatted about this on the air. But so, for example, when the Senate didn't vote to consider Merrick Garland, is that right?
Yep, Merrick Garland.
In the second term of the Obama presidency, there was nothing illegal about that, right? It's just the case that the Senate has the power to consider judicial nominees like that. But but it was pretty clearly like a violation of norms. So we consider this matter and we're wrestling with the fact that the constitutional language is so vague. I think the vagueness of it is useful just because impeachment as a political solution it's really important, right? There are going to be times in which having the power to remove a federally appointed official, whether it's a judge or a president, from office is going to be really important for us. Consider again even just our history and how important democratic control over who's in power, how important that is to us. And it's a good thing, I think, that language is drawn broadly, because one can almost never anticipate and consider what the future might hold and the conditions under which we want to remove an elected official from office. And so the thing in the Trump case, I don't know how much of the Mueller report you've sat down and read.
I know it's none. I've read summaries and articles. I've read none of the actual report.
Yeah. And so for me, the same. We might well disagree on the facts of the case. I mean, maybe we wouldn't. I don't really know. I mean, to me, I think it's very reasonable to think that the president engaged in what? In obstruction of justice, in activities that seem treasonous. I mean, I think coordinating with foreign governments to influence an election, you know, receiving campaign funding even from foreign officials that, you know, start to get pretty serious. And now the question is it serious enough? And it's just a hard question.
So does it matter? And this won't necessarily apply to some of the details of the report, but in terms of violation of norms and his, you know, tweeting behavior and so on, does it matter at all that people knew about all of that before he got elected and voted for him anyway? Should that affect our impeachment calculus?
It does affect it. And I mean, so I made the point earlier and you expressed a reservation about it. I mean, one reason to hesitate is that he is, well, I mean, this actually is controversial, but let's say in any case, a large percentage of the American population is supportive of the president. And I think it's pretty uncontroversial that an actual impeachment hearing would be incredibly divisive for the country. I mean, that was, you know, that was true of the Clinton presidency too. There's obviously no chance that he actually gets removed from office, right? I mean,
oh, sure. The Senate will not remove him, barring some kind of something. And honestly, I don't think his popularity will be affected because nothing has affected.
Oh, like no,
his,
no, no.
His course. Popularity has been 40% since February of the year he took office.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I think it helps his popularity because he can be seen as being a victim. You know, I guess to finally answer your question, if I were a congressperson in Congress, I think I would not vote to impeach the president. Because I know that the odds of him actually being removed from office are basically nil. And I think the damage that it would do, at least right now with what we know, something else came out, but the damage that I think it would do would be severe enough to want to sort of settle this in the political process and just vote him out of office.
And so again, speaking about the violation of norms as a potential reason for impeachment, do you think Trump is genuinely outside of kind of American cultural norms of the present?
You know, I was having a conversation with a colleague who was trying to argue that this is basically just the same thing, that the kinds of things that Lyndon Johnson would say in office behind closed doors are basically equivalent to the kinds of things that Donald Trump would say.
I don't even necessarily mean that. I think these are the sorts of things that people say on Twitter and in YouTube comments and at rallies of either political side. I don't think that's even a controversial statement. I think people actually do that. Are there enough people doing that that we can just say, yeah, that's what our culture is now, and Donald Trump really isn't the outlier? He is the outlier in that he is one of the politicians who does it publicly rather than being sort of reserved with it, but he is not out of line with the American people.
So you're just talking about the tweeting. I mean,
Or the ignorance of government, the kind of boorish incompetence. I mean,
you know, yeah, so for me, that's not... I'm going to say something kind of subtle here. Like, I think the fact that that's just the culture of the medium isn't a particularly persuasive argument for me, because that might be the culture of the medium, but it's not the culture of the medium for elected officials. And so that's important.
But is it the culture of the American people? And if he's a legitimate reflection of that culture, does that mean maybe it's not an impeachable ground?
No, well, but the subtle bit that I was going to get to is that, but I don't think that the tweeting and the vacationing and the coarse language by itself is impeachable. I mean, to me, the question is the extent to which he engaged in criminal political activity and soliciting help from a foreign government and obstructing justice. Right. That to me is the object, not the crazy talk.
Right. And yeah, I will be really surprised if he actually did any of those things. Just not because I don't think he would have, but because I doubt his capacity to do so. I don't think he has the competence for masterminding crimes behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, conspiracy requires coordination, but it doesn't require, genius level coordination. I mean, you're right, the tricky thing, and I think this was an aspect of Mueller's reticence to go beyond what he said in the report, was that proving mens rea, right, the criminal state of mind that's necessary for some of these criminal acts to be in play is like a super difficult thing. I mean, it just is a difficult thing. Like, how do you prove that a person's state of mind was like they are intentionally performing an act that they know to be illegal? That's tricky. But I mean, this is just me. I mean, I have no doubt that he was like, yeah, let's collude, to use the word of the day.
Huh. And again, I would be surprised if that were the case. I have no doubt he said, hey, whatever information comes our way, let's use. As poorly stated as it was, I even understand his point of saying, yeah, of course we would have used it had they given us the information, because anyone would, and why wouldn't you? And like, is any candidate on any campaign going to turn aside information that's damaging to their opponent and pretend they don't know it?
Well, sometimes they do, actually, and especially when they come from foreign governments.
Right. So, yeah, I'm more skeptical. I don't think that at any point he said to himself, this information was illegally obtained from whoever, right? Whatever illegal source, and I'm going to use it anyway. I would be really surprised if that turned out to be the case, because I don't think that is within the bounds of his abilities.
I think what am I trying to say? I think you're not giving the president enough credit. I mean, he's clearly mercurial. He'll say whatever's on his mind. But I mean, his whole business career is one of like flouting the law, breaking contracts, doing all of that stuff. He just doesn't care about the rules. Like, he knows that there are rules, but he just doesn't care about them. All he cares about is doing whatever is going to satisfy his ego at the time. And
right.
I don't know why that it's hard to believe that he was like, this is against the law, but we're going to do it because it's helpful for me. That's
he's
had that thought a billion times in his life.
I think this is one of the more interesting questions that's come out of the Mueller report. Apparently, at several points along the way, and again, it wasn't necessarily Trump, but it was people within the administration who attempted to obstruct justice and did such a bad job of it that they actually end up helping out with the investigation. Mm-hmm. I think attempted obstruction of justice is a crime, but it's not a crime on the same scale as actual obstruction of justice. And of course, that then leads into the question of, well, if you're trying to impeach someone, maybe obstruction of justice is a legitimate reason to do so, is attempted obstruction of justice, especially when the result is not only not obstruction, but actually helping out the investigation just because you do such a terrible job of it.
Yeah, you know, so attempted murder isn't as bad as murder.
True.
But it's pretty bad. You know, and in some ways, attempted murder, you know, there are interesting debates about the role of chance in our moral evaluations that philosophers think about. But, like, I mean, attempted murder is, in some ways, is just as bad, right? I mean, the fact that you missed is an accident. The thing that's significant is that you really were trying to kill somebody, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, attempted obstruction of justice, sure, it's not as bad as if you're successful, but only in a pretty limited technical way. I mean, it shows the mens rea of wanting to flout the law. Like, why should why should we be less concerned about incompetent people who are trying to break the law?
But it also might merit a different scale of punishment, right? So I may want to see the murderer executed and the attempted murderer just in prison.
Sure.
Right, I may want to see the president who actually obstructs justice impeached, and the president who attempts to obstruct justice, well, I don't know if that merits impeachment or not.
So yeah, I guess that's a little bit less clear to me, or more clear to me. I don't have that grammatical.
And that leads into what are other alternatives, but we can get to that towards the end.
Well, yeah, I mean, they could always vote to censure, you know, but that isn't particularly significant.
I think they've done that. I'm not entirely sure. But
you know, and I have to say, the number of Republican senators, I guess, who've been willing to criticize the president's most recent verbal attacks on congressmen and the go back home language has been a little bit surprising to me. Like, yeah, like, surprising in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans have been fairly consistent at criticizing his more egregious tweets and actions and public statements. But at the end of the day, and I think that your point about he's not going to be removed from office is probably right, just because whatever, you know, semi-objective standard of impeachment we could come up with, the reality on the ground is this is going to be a partisan vote one way or another. It's going to be Democrats and Republicans lining up, and you might have one or two from each party who switch sides, but it's not going to be enough, certainly not going to be enough to remove him from office. And it's not going to be enough to do anything other than just further polarize the country.
Yeah. And that to me really is the thing. I mean, the reason why this is a hard issue is precisely because the real underlying problem is the fact that there's such incredible division in the country.
Right. So I'm less concerned about undermining an election, in part because if he is impeached and removed, you know, Mike Pence was also elected. It's not as if it goes to a federal judge or something. Right. I mean, there's still the, and of course he is being removed by officials who are also elected. It's not undermining a democracy. It's a process within our republic that we've set up for this purpose. But I don't know that would outweigh the partisan damage that would be done.
Yeah. Yeah. That gets to the norms thing. I mean, clearly they could do, right? That's right. Just what the law says. But it's a question of norms, and then I guess I think he actually has done things that are impeachable, but given the particular context and our political moment at the time, I actually think that it's not necessarily the best thing for our country to actually impeach him.
Right. I guess I would say.
But if he wins the next election, I reserve the right to change my mind.
It's certainly a lot easier once he's a lame duck president. I don't know that I think he's done things that are impeachable, with the caveat that I've not actually read the Mueller report. Partially because I think we knew what we were getting into when we elected him, so a lot of the norms and such, you know, I don't know that those are impeachable because they were there.
I just don't know. I mean, I don't know how that matters.
I mean, if Yeah, yeah.
And you know, for what it's worth, I mean, going back to the day before Trump took office, or the day after the election, or whatever, would you say that these 3 years, or 2 or 3 years, 2.5 years, are about what you expected, better than you expected, or worse than you expected?
I think probably a little better than I expected, but I had
I had
pretty low expectations.
I would
say. And I will point out that the day he took office, articles of impeachment had already been filed against him by Elizabeth Warren, no less. Something like 2 months earlier, month and a half earlier, something like that.
How can Elizabeth Warren draft articles of impeachment if she's a senator?
Yeah, well, again, it was obviously political grandstanding. But again, so I think that it is better than I thought it would be, at least in part because I know he's put good judges in place. I genuinely thought he would put his sister on the Supreme Court, and I was wrong about that. And I thought he would put people more in line with kind of his historic views about politics, but he has actually kept his word there, and put perfectly qualified, good originalists on the various courts around the country. And there are ways in which it's about what I expected. I mean, there are still hundreds of, you know, government jobs that have not been filled, some of which don't matter and some of which do. Do we currently have a Secretary of State, or are we still missing one?
Oh, we have to have one, don't we?
I don't know.
Googling.
Sure.
Mike Pompeo?
Okay, there we go. We do have one.
But it is obviously an indicator of our times that you and I are both like, do we actually have one?
Right. And to be fair, the cabinet appointments he's made have all been fine. The train wreck has been the White House staff, but I,
you know,
care much less about that.
Know,
let that train wreck.
I'm going to disagree on fine. Elaine Chao.
Is there anyone more qualified for that office than her?
Her malfeasance in office is the deals that she's been doing in China and taking family members who are conducting business in China is sketchy.
Since she's taken office.
I'm sorry?
Is that since she's taken office?
Yeah. I mean, she's
actually done any follow-up on her. I just know going into it, like, she'd been assistant secretary for that position. She'd served in the cabinet before.
Oh, sure. I mean, before I would have said, yeah, she's an adult. I mean, she's an adult. But there have been all kinds of controversies about her family is in the real estate business. And they're conducting business in China, and she's bringing family members along as part of the official delegation.
Hmm. Right, I would have said the weak link in the cabinet is Ben Carson, I have heard nothing whatsoever from that department, so maybe he's doing a fine job.
Well,
or maybe he's just asleep. I don't know, but that's kind of the exception. Most of the others have all been fine. Like I said, the massive turnover and the awful stories are all coming out of the White House, and that is also less surprising.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got on any of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So the last item that we have to talk about is whether or not there is some kind of a Christian view on matters of impeachment.
Yeah. What do you think? Like, is there anything distinctly Christian that's not just either just partisan, or not going to just line up with either a progressive view or a conservative view or whatever? When we put that question down, I really don't know what I think about it.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this a little bit. The general issue. I mean, I think the answer to that question is pretty clearly no. I don't think there's any distinctively Christian view that comes out, aside from all of the general kinds of considerations about why impeachment is an important, though delicate, kind of a political instrument for a democratic republic to have. And the general thought on scripture, just theologically, is that, like, we often want scripture to sort of answer, well, I mean, day-to-day issues and puzzles that arise that we want guidance on. And, you know, scripture lays out important, broad theological truths and principles, and moral truths and principles, but they're all pretty broad. I think in some ways there's danger in trying to draw out too much detail and specificity out of scripture, or we certainly need to tread lightly. Whatever else scripture it is, it isn't a textbook or even systematic treatment of issues of, well, certainly ethics, political morality, even in some ways theology, I want to say. So there's a little bit important emphasis there on systematic,
right,
you know, right. Of the kind that academic theologians or religious ethicists, you know, right.
Yeah, I mean, I could certainly see circumstances where, on a practical level, Christians have a different view of whether or not someone should be impeached. You know, should a president be impeached for, say, unrepentant adultery? I could see a Christian saying, yeah, you know, maybe that's grounds for it, and someone who's not a Christian saying, yeah, that's, you know, 50% of marriages these days, so... You know, and I mean, we could come up with several issues where a Christian might say, no, that's not actually impeachable, or yes, it is. But in terms of the process itself, yeah, I don't know that there's anything other than, like you said, that it is a healthy process to have, because you don't want anyone who is untouchable, right? If only because of the doctrine of original sin, you need that check in place. So. Yeah, no, with that said, I think there are probably grounds for lesser forms of discipline, whether we're Christian or not. I wouldn't hate seeing the travel budget for the White House eliminated. I mean, if you really want to discipline Trump, take away his travel money and take away his phone budget and make him either pay for it himself or just stay in the White House all the time, and I think that
phone
would do
budget.
More good. Communications budget.
You're talking about, okay.
No tweeting, yeah. You can pay for it all yourself, which the phone wouldn't actually affect anything.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure
he can presumably afford
the president
that.
President can afford a $100 a month Verizon package.
But I suspect the weekly trips to Mar-a-Lago would add up pretty quickly, especially if he has to pay for all of his security on the way. But again, that's even that I think is highly unlikely. I think it would be a better route than impeachment. Some kind of institutional discipline would be much better. But even that, I don't think you're going to get the Senate on board with it.
Yeah. So to sum up, neither of us think that he should be impeached, though I think that he's probably committed impeachable offenses, and you think that he probably has.
I mean, yeah. Unless you want to make the case that he has done so much damage that he can no longer effectively be president. In which case, I think that's probably the best argument that can be made. He is so awful that the government is no longer properly functioning as much as it ever properly functions. And I'm happy to agree he's awful. I don't know that I think he's that awful. You look like you disagree.
No, I'm just thinking about that. I mean, how much do we want to finesse? You know, so, I mean, he's not a serial killer.
Right.
He doesn't strangle puppies.
Now, that may also be a function of polarization, right? It may, like, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and those 40% of people who think he's doing a good job would still think he's doing a good job.
I literally think that is true.
I do also think that's true. So all of this is ultimately a bad reflection on us, because this is, you know, that's the nation we're in now.
I literally think that if he was walking down Fifth Avenue and saw AOC and shot her in cold blood, literally nothing would happen.
Now, I think the other side of that is also true. You know, he could tomorrow donate all of his wealth to, you know, whatever the most popular charity is today, and the people who don't like him still won't like him. Like, that's also not going to change anything. So it's both ways.
Sure. Okay. Well, maybe we should work out articles of impeachment for the Christian Humanist Radio Network.
We
should. I think we should impeach Nathan Gilmore, who's clearly out of his mind and a danger to himself and the network, and replace him with Kristen Filipic.
So she's like the vice president of the network?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know. None of this is written up, so we can just write all of this up. You and I could write this up tonight and
That's
sign
true.
It. A coup.
We're like the House of Representatives. It means
whatever
we want. You know,
but I don't
want
to impeach. I want a coup. Coup is so much like sexier and interesting.
Sounds like a lot of work, though.
We're going to overthrow the whole network. We're going to change the passwords to the servers and take over all of the shows. You and me. You ready for this?
That sounds like so much work, Ed. I don't want to do that.
All the shows. The main show. Profiles. Danny. I mean, we can't trust Danny. He's reckless, that guy.
It's fair. I'm trying to think if I could even name everyone on all of the other shows.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
We'd be removing people we don't know.
Book of Nature. What do those guys know about science? You and me.
They believe in, like, climate change and stuff, Ed.
I
mean,
know,
clearly they're
crazy.
Dangerous radicals.
It's crazy. They're buying into this Illuminati conspiracy.
There you go. You
okay.
Didn't watch the debates last night.
No.
Oh, okay.
I just don't have the stomach for it. I read about them in the morning.
You missed the Delaney plan for, like, robots in the sky to capture carbon. It was interesting, to say the least.
That's the future. We're going to have drones flying around in the atmosphere, soaking up CO2 and pooping diamonds. That's my solution to the climate change crisis.
There you
but
go.
First, I want to just take over the Christian Humanist Radio Network and have a coup.
You start small, right? And then
that's
and
right. Build. It's proof of concept. I want to make
there
sure I
go.
Can do it. All right. Well, the City of Man, at least for now, is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. At least for now, our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family. You can get more information about all of our shows at christianhumanist.org. That's the URL for now. Pretty soon it will be edisincharge.org. But anyways, please kindly leave us a review on iTunes. You can like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Or email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.